You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 8th of June 2023 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, we'll begin in Washington as Mike Pence confirms he will be challenging his former boss for the Republican presidential nomination. But how will that election be covered as CNN loses its CEO and the future direction of the news network is called into question? Then we'll cross to Ukraine as the impact of the Kakhovka dam explosion continues to spread. And international broadcaster Nina Dos Santos is here for a look at the day's papers. Nina, what's caught your eye?
I'm afraid to say it's artificial intelligence again. It's AI, AI, AI in the news every single day, it seems, at the moment. And this time, it's one of the biggest tech companies, Microsoft, now pushing back, saying stop the fear-mongering on AI.
Thank you, Nina. We'll also hear from Senegal, until recently one of the most stable countries in Africa, now descending into violence and chaos. We'll examine the stigma around tattoos in Japan and how that's been affecting the military recruitment process. We'll have a check on the latest aviation news, plus... That's the sound of the highly toxic cane toad, lethal to predators, which are being trained not to eat them. But how ethical is human intervention in wildlife behaviour? That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. We begin the show in Washington. Mike Pence, Donald Trump's former deputy, has thrown his hat into the presidential ring. Kevin McCarthy is facing a revolt from hardline Republicans, and British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is meeting Joe Biden today. Well, Lewis Lukens is a senior partner at Signum Global Advisors and a former US diplomat. He's on the line now. Lou, let's listen to a snippet from Pence's launch video for his campaign, in which he promised a different kind of leadership from his predecessor.
But today, our country's in a lot of trouble. President Joe Biden and the radical left have weakened America at home and abroad. The American dream is being crushed under runaway inflation. Wages are dropping. Recession is looming. Our southern border is under siege, and the enemies of freedom are on the march around the world. And worse still, timeless American values are under assault as never before. We're better than this.
Lou Lukens, Pence is the first vice president in modern history to take on his former running mate. It's worth looking at the relationship between the two men. How would you describe it?
Well, Michael Pence has an almost impossible task. He was Donald Trump's loyal aide, assistant, lapdog, whatever you want to call it, for 4 years, enabling Donald Trump as he sort of tore through the American political landscape. And now he's trying very hard to distance himself and set up a wall between himself and Donald Trump. And I think it's going to be very difficult for him to do. He obviously had a very close relationship with Donald Trump for 4 years, but he is trying very hard now to attack Donald. He is attacking Donald Trump. And it just comes across as with a bit of dissonance.
Mm. I mean, polls say that Pence has almost no chance. But in what way could his campaign be an important litmus test?
Well, he could probably, I mean, what he's trying to do is take the, so he was brought on board basically in Trump's first campaign to help shore up the base, especially the evangelical base. Trump is an evangelical Christian. He's always been very close to that community, and they had real doubts about Donald Trump given his sort of personal history. So Michael Pence was brought onto the ticket in 2016 to sort of reassure the evangelical base that Donald Trump is not such a bad guy. That base, the evangelical base, still likes Donald Trump. They don't love his personal style or his lifestyle, but they like the fact that he appointed conservative judges and all of that. Mike Pence is trying to get those evangelicals back from Trump now and say, I'm the true Christian, I'm the true evangelical, I'm the one who will actually represent your values. I think it's a very difficult task for him, but that's what he's trying to do.
Mm. Now, let's look at the GOP more generally. The U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy faces a revolt from hardline Republicans. Why is this?
Well, he made promises to them in order to become speaker. You'll remember back in January, it took 15 votes, a couple of days of voting for him to actually gain the speakership. And they feel that he has not lived up to his commitments, especially around the question of cutting the government budget. And Kevin McCarthy worked with Joe Biden to sort of craft this deal a couple of weeks ago to raise the U.S. debt limit, but at the same time, basically to cap government spending, not really to cut it that much. And the hardline Freedom Caucus and the Republican Conference of the House of Representatives feels that he broke his promises to them, and they want to see the government budget cut more. So they're holding up all business on the floor of the House right now until they can basically negotiate a new deal with him.
So what happens? Could McCarthy be pushed out?
I don't think he's likely to be pushed out. The people within his party could trigger another election vote or another leadership vote and try to kick him out. But I don't think they have enough votes for that. So I think McCarthy would survive that. And I think they realize that, and that's why they haven't pulled that trigger yet. But what they can do is gum up the works and make life very difficult for him for the next year and a half.
And what does this tell us about the state of the GOP?
Well, the GOP is, you know, people used to say that the Democrats were sort of a big tent party representing many, many different sort of factions within the party. And I think now, and they still do, but the Republicans were always sort of monolithic, and now they represent a much broader base. So you've got the hardcore sort of social policy, Trump-like conservatives, and you have the more traditional Republican sort of small government pro-business conservatives, and they're trying to figure out how to get along in the next, you know, in this Congress, and they're struggling with that because their goals are very, very different. And the Freedom Caucus is empowered because McCarthy only has a 4-seat majority or 5-seat majority in the House, so he can't afford to lose more than a couple of people from his caucus every time there's a vote. So, you know, they are flexing their political muscles, the Freedom Caucus, and making life very difficult for the more traditional sort of Reagan-like Republicans.
Might we see a split?
I don't think we'll see a split. There's nowhere for the sort of the hardcore, you know, pro-Trump conservatives to go. So I think they're perfectly happy to stay within the party and just make life difficult for the leadership.
Mm. Now, Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, is in Washington meeting with Joe Biden. Do we know what's on that agenda?
Well, a couple things are they're certainly going to talk about Ukraine, certainly in the aftermath of the dam destruction this week. And I think the United States will reinforce its commitment to Ukraine and also be sure to very publicly thank the United Kingdom for its strong support for Ukraine as well. I think the U.S. and the U.K. have, between the two of them, have been the two strongest countries in support of Ukraine. Sunak has a couple of other things on his plate. He wants to talk about trade. There is not going to be a free trade agreement, but he's hoping for a more targeted, maybe a digital trade agreement to try to improve the way that digital trade happens between our countries. He's very focused on AI, as I think Joe Biden is. I think Sunak wants to, he's going to propose that the global community establish a new regulatory body to oversee the sort of unrolling of AI around the country and track it, monitor it, and regulate it, and propose that that body be based in London. I don't think that's likely to happen. I think Joe Biden will feel we can probably work through existing frameworks to do that and don't need to create a whole new structure. But AI, Ukraine, trade, NATO, they've got a lot to cover today.
Mm. I wonder if anyone apart from the British Tory party really cares. I mean, how important is the UK to the US now?
Well, it's important in some ways and not as important in other ways, right? I mean, I think this obsession that since Brexit that the Tory party has had on reaching a comprehensive trade agreement with the United States is not going to happen in part because, A, the trade balance is already very strong between our countries, but also it's just not that important for the United States. On security and intelligence matters, especially as they pertain to the war in Ukraine, but also globally, the United Kingdom remains extremely important to the United States.
Mm. I mean, you were with the U.S. Embassy here in Britain. I wonder how that relationship, how you've seen the so-called special relationship change during that time since Brexit.
Well, I was at the embassy, you know, mostly during the Trump years, and the special relationship was certainly strained during those years because Trump was so he was personally unpredictable and was, you know, he attacked British leaders and did a lot of things that made the relationship not quite so special. And in addition to which, his policies were very unpredictable, and that made sort of the continuity and the maintaining of a relationship very difficult. That is now stabilized again, and I think we have a much more traditional administration in Washington, and I think 10 Downing Street appreciates that. And the fact that Sunak and Biden are now meeting today for the fourth or fifth time this year, I think indicates that sort of that relationship is back on a more even keel.
Lou, thank you very much indeed. That was former US diplomat Louis Lukens, and this is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Eleven past nine in Kyiv and 7:11 here in London. As we've been reporting, tens of thousands of people are at risk from the flooding triggered by explosions at the Kharkovka Dam in southern Ukraine. We're going to get an update now from Victoria Voitsiska, who's a former Ukrainian MP and secretary of the Parliamentary Committee on Fuel, Energy, Nuclear Policies and Security. Victoria, many thanks for joining us on Monocle Radio. What does the breach of the dam mean for Ukraine's much-awaited counteroffensive?
Yes, thank you very much for having me. When we talk about Ukrainian counteroffensive, we all understand that no one, except for those who are directing and managing the counteroffensive, knows exact plans and directions where it should go, where which targets it should reach at what point. So it's really hard to make any reasonable and conclusions on this matter. What we can say for sure is that those plans that Russians had with respect to occupying Mykolaiv, occupying Odessa, and closing the access to Black Sea for Ukraine, that is gone. They are not going to make it. That's we can be absolutely sure of.
Now, just I know that you were former secretary of the Parliamentary Committee on Nuclear Policies. The IAEA says that there is no immediate nuclear safety risk. But Oleksiy Danilov, who's Zelensky's top security official, has warned that Russia might be plotting to target the Zaporizhia nuclear plant. From your perspective, how likely is this?
Well, for as long as nuclear terrorists controls one of the biggest, if not the biggest, nuclear power plant on European soil, well, we can expect anything. Look, we knew about Russia mining Kharkovka Dam last year. We were saying it to the world. We were warning that Russians could use it to blackmail Ukraine as well and create major disaster. And it did happen. When it comes to Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, I agree with IAEA, International Atomic Agency assessment, that there are no immediate risks because there are special pools near the plant that they have enough water for the cooling, but the plant itself requires a constant access to the water, and without having the water access, and this is what we see already, that the pools cannot be filled with water from natural process because the water level drops. Then it becomes an issue whether Russian soldiers will demine the bank of Dnipro River to bring the special equipment to pump the water for the cooling purposes. We don't know that. And for that very reason, I believe it's hard time to make a final decision that it's important to have not just IAEA that doesn't have tools, that doesn't have actually mandate to control militarily the asset and the area around it. We need to have humanitarian mission of NATO to protect this particular asset of the high risk for that poses a high risk, not just for Ukraine, but for European continent as a whole.
Mm. Let's focus now on the dam. We know that hundreds of thousands are now without drinking water. Many are being evacuated. What is the latest on the humanitarian crisis caused by the dam explosion? Victoria, we're just having a little bit of difficulty hearing you there for the moment. We're just going to see if we can get you back on the line. What is the latest on the humanitarian crisis caused by the dam explosion?
The humanitarian crisis.
I'm very sorry, but it appears that Victoria's line has dropped out there. But very interesting to talk to her about the fallout from that dam explosion. Now, still to come on the programme, large and warty cane toads are wreaking havoc in Australia. We'll find out why scientists around the world are working to change the behaviour of wild animals. This is The Globalist. Yesterday, the CEO of CNN, Chris Licht, was ousted from the network after just 13 months in the job. His departure comes as the cable news network faces unprecedented turmoil as ratings and profits have plummeted. Well, I'm joined now by Monocle's US editor, Chris Lord. Chris, why did this happen? Why was he ousted? Did he jump? Was he fired?
It's been a tumultuous week for Chris Licht. So I think just to rewind and understand a bit more about who he is and where he's come from, and in a way it sets the scene for this really very sort of inharmonious end to his time at CNN. So last year, CNN's parent company, Warner Media, merged with Discovery and to form this new company, which they put a guy called David Zaslav in charge of that company. And his job was to find a new head for CNN. Of course, we remember famously that it lost its head just last year when Zucker had a very unceremonious leaving himself. Now, Chris Licht was the exec producer of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. He launched Morning Joe on MSNBC. This is a guy with proper news chops in the business, and people all over this country will be familiar with him in newsrooms. He's worked these various places with lots and lots of power. So he made a natural case to be there. And when Licht came in, this first thing that he tried to do was try and make CNN less partisan. They went around and spoke to viewers and said, you know, what is it you want from this network? Which, again, since the Trump presidency had come to an end, CNN was already seeing its numbers come down. And viewers said, well, we want it to be more centrist. We want to hear both sides of the story. We don't want to feel like we're watching an op-ed with a very Democratic party leaning. So Licht has tried to do that. And in a way, he came in very hard. You know, he cut staff. He really went into newsrooms and said, you know, those who don't want to follow me can leave. And it was a very, if you like, a great deal of upheaval in the CNN newsrooms. The problem was he lost the newsroom ultimately. Lots of people didn't agree with the way he was taking the brand and with the newsroom. And of course, there was the famous case when we saw this town hall with Donald Trump. An obvious attempt to try and say, well, you know, you would never have heard this on the CNN of before. Look now, we're trying to listen to the other camp. Here's Donald. And of course, it just unraveled. It became a very combative Donald Trump show and anathema to many staffers. Now, the big problem that happened at the start of this week was that The Atlantic wrote a piece, very powerful it is, 15,000 words, a real deep dive into Chris Licht. And the access that this reporter got was astonishing. I mean, it was going to the gym with him, hearing him on record criticize past coverage on CNN. He also paints a picture of a very self-absorbed news editor. And of course, you know, when this lands at the start of the week, lots and read over the weekend in CNN newsrooms and all over the country, it was a very damning portrait. And as soon as that landed, really anybody with reading the runes of the media landscape here and knowing how unpopular Chris Licht has been in CNN, you could really see it was setting the scene for what we saw on Wednesday morning.
So what happens now? I mean, what are the future plans for CNN? Because obviously it's going to have to establish a distinct role in the news landscape. Which direction will it go?
It's a very, very tricky moment because with the departure of Chris Licht, it raises the question of, so what now? Do you try and go back to the way things were where, you know, during the Trump presidency, this was very much the opposition's television channel to go to? Do you try and go down that route and really try and reverse what he brought to it? Or do you continue down this route, but with someone else who can be more, if you like, more charming and more personable? Some of the things that really a lot of people said Chris Licht didn't really have, especially with some of the talent that was in CNN. But I think there's a bigger reality of what this story reveals, which is that broadcast media in the US, there's two things here. One of anyone who watches the broadcast media in the US who comes in from the outside always says, I can't believe how partisan it is. I can't believe often the tone of some of the TV coverage of the news, where A, it's obviously so clear the political leaning, but also the certain sense of it's the end of the world when things go wrong, when Republicans are in power, all that kind of stuff. That, or on vice versa, of course, on the conservative media and the way that they paint liberal politics. All that, what we call, you know, sort of a partisan bent in American TV news. Unfortunately, it's revealed in a way, the Chris Licht episode, that it's not as simple as that. You can't simply try and create an even-handed centrist broadcast network because that's what you want to do. It just isn't that simple. Newsrooms are clearly more entrenched in certain ways of doing things. And also the viewer isn't as necessarily so easily convinced that that's what you're trying to do. Hence the whole town hall debacle for CNN. So it presents a real issue. And I think if you put it alongside what's happened at, you know, if you like CNN's counterpart, Fox News, they've lost Tucker Carlson. They've lost, in a way, their most vocal, big draw, audience winner in the last 6 months. So you've got these two major networks that are really, in a way, lacking a rudder as we're entering a period where TV news traditionally came into its own. We're going to go into an election in 2024. And in fact, you know, if you just look now in the way that the run-up to the Republican primaries are being covered, you know, there is this gap, in a way, of the traditional way that the news was told here, where in so many ways TV news set the agenda. And even if you're watching a lot of this via social media, you will see that typical trickle down of those views of those big people involved in broadcast media in this country, they're just not being heard in the way they are. And you look at those numbers, 61% down for CNN, 27% down for Fox. These are big broadcasters who very typically define the narrative here, and they are not being watched as they used to be.
Chris Lord, thank you very much indeed. Well, it's time now to have a look at the papers, and joining me is Nina Dos Santos. She's an international broadcaster and CNN's former Europe editor. And I know because of that role, you probably can't comment on the last story, but I think you might agree that Tom Wormskamps is obviously the right guy for the job.
Who knows? I mean, these are huge jobs and there are huge cyclical changes afoot in the media industry, not least in the United States, because of course, the advent of streaming, which is going to be the future. So I think a lot of what we're seeing here in terms of sort of the musical chairs at the top of large media organizations around the world, and obviously the big money is in the United States. Mm. So this is why all the focus is on that. And of course, there's a big election coming up, which is always the big event in the news calendar over there during election cycles. You know, there's cyclical changes that have been afoot for as long as I have been a journalist. Mm. So it really is incumbent upon all bosses at media organisations to try and get on the front foot and try and tackle those too, not just, as you heard from your correspondent there, the attendant issues that people running big networks face at the moment.
Mm. Now, I was on the phone yesterday to somebody in New York. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon there. He said it felt like the apocalypse. The sky went orange. It was dark. People were coughing. He got text alerts telling him not to go outside, that his kids couldn't go to school, that kind of thing. What's going on?
So there are wildfires in Canada. In fact, it's the worst wildfire season that Canada has ever had in its history. I think 12 times more land has been burnt than the 10-year average, and we're only in the month of June, and these wildfires they think are going to continue. At the moment, they're focused in Quebec, which is going to have to evacuate about forcibly perhaps about 15,000 residents because it's so dangerous. And the smoke has been wafting all the way towards the east coast of the United States, settling on New York City in particular, but heading further down the coast as well. And this is a huge wake-up call to the capitalist center of America about how climate change really is affecting people's daily lives, because you and I have probably spent quite a bit of time in New York City, partly because we're in broadcast, and it is, as we mentioned before, the epicenter of broadcast decision making in the United States. And it's amazing to think that this has now become real for the capitalist center of America that is financing so many businesses, that are big manufacturing businesses that may be taking action on climate change or maybe trying to see it as a problem that's sort of somewhat divorced from their day-to-day reality no longer. Now New York City's having to distribute N95 masks to people today. They're saying that you can't go outside. Broadway shows are being cancelled. Sporting fixtures are being cancelled. Again, that costs people money. Also important for the media industry because they also broadcast these sporting events as well. And more seriously, apparently it's very dangerous for pregnant women to go outside and children as well to, you know, partake in their day-to-day sports. So again, it's another reminder that for the city that doesn't sleep, it has to pause because of climate change and climate change that might not even be in the United States or anywhere near New York. But the point is, it affects everybody.
For once, America can blame Canada. let's have a look at this new poll. Europeans who see Russia as an adversary or a rival double in number.
Yeah, that's right. So what's happened here is that the European Council of Foreign Relations has done a survey of about 11 EU states. I must caution, I don't think the UK is inside this, obviously, because after Brexit, it's not been considered as part of this poll. But yes, they've noticed that the war in Ukraine has really polarised people's opinions against Russia, and that is particularly heightened when it comes to people in the Nordic countries, the Baltic countries, those nations that feel most at threat from Russia, and also, of course, as you'd expect, Poland, which is on the other side of the border from Ukraine. But interestingly enough, a smaller proportion of Eastern Europeans still have a sort of more nuanced view about whether or not Russia should eventually in the future be engaged economically with the EU. So it's interesting because obviously what this does is this is the backdrop to a piece of research to try and lobby for more spending militarily comprehensively for the EU. You can feel that here. And what you're feeling and sensing inside this report here is that more Europeans generally want some kind of comprehensive force to try and be ready to push back against Russia if, of course, we have an even more belligerent Russia than one that has invaded a European country just outside of the EU's borders. But one thing that is interesting in this report is that more or less, and we've heard this time and time again, every time you hear the leaders of France and Germany get on the podium, is that EU citizens don't want to rely on the United States to do that, to play that crucial role. Slightly more nuanced views in this report, though, on China, which is quite interesting because a lot of countries' citizens appear to think that, well, it's fine to still have a very highly developed trade relationship with China, even though they're aware of concerns of potential industrial espionage and so on and so forth.
And of course, all of this will be coming up when Rishi Sunak speaks to Joe Biden today. Another major topic of discussion between the two men is AI. Rishi Sunak wants to put in place a framework. He'd like that to be run from here in the UK. And the head of Microsoft, meanwhile, has said, stop fear-mongering.
Yeah, this is a really contrarian view, isn't it, from one of the big tech titans, considering as you had all of these different smaller players who become extremely important in the sector. I'm thinking, you know, OpenAI's founder and CEO Sam Altman famously telling senators in Washington, D.C. that, you know, AI could be the end of us. It needs to absolutely be regulated. And he got together various CEOs of startups that have become quite big and influential in this space recently to try and write an open letter demanding regulation because they were saying it could eventually kill humanity, if you like. So Rishi Sunak has now gotten on the front foot. As some people might say, this is post-Brexit Britain being rather ambitious on the international stage. He pushes back on that, Rishi Sunak, because he says, look, I've been talking about the dangers of AI for about 2 years, for anybody who's been listening to me, and I do think that the UK, with its technological know-how, remember that the UK's got quite a big tech hub in East London, and there's a big tech conference happening as we speak, actually, this week, which is where those comments on Microsoft come from. But also, we have things like GCHQ, we've invested heavily in computer science at universities and so on and so forth. So he says the UK is in a privileged position to be able to deliver that with the United States. It's looking ambitious, if I'm honest with you, Georgina. But hey, you know, obviously, Brad Smith from Microsoft, presumably there must have been conversations between the UK and Microsoft. I'm not privy to those, whether or not there were. But you can tell that obviously the UK government has reached out to a lot of tech firms to sort of take soundings on whether or not they would support this idea of regulation. And Microsoft, actually, Brad Smith from Microsoft, in this article in the Times and the Guardian that I'm referring to here, made comments to say that, look, we do have a vision of how AI could be regulated, and that could involve licenses and so on and so forth. So you can get the sense that both the United States and the UK are working with big players in industry to try and find some way forward. But it isn't the big players in the industry who are setting the narrative on this at the moment. That version of sort of Project Fear, AI-wise, if you like, is coming from not the big Microsofts, but smaller players who are quite influential.
AI, AIO. So let's have a look at Old MacDonald's farm produce shop, which isn't doing so well at the moment. In fact, there's been a massive shift in food shopping habits as prices obviously are going up all over the world.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. This is a survey that's been done by Kantar, a consumer goods research firm that's quite influential in the UK. Now, just to be clear, it's studying UK shopping habits, but the UK grocery market is a huge player in the world and does also set the trend. And what they're finding is that, obviously, surprise, surprise, because of the exorbitant cost of living in the UK, we're shopping less, we're buying more when we do shop. When we buy anything and go for those big, now weekly shops rather than day-to-day shops, we'll be buying more at the end of the month. And that goes to show that there's pressures on pay packets. You know, when people reach the 27th day of the month, get their pay packet, they're more likely to go shopping and do a big shop then. Personally, coming from London, I find that things expire in the supermarkets, I don't know about you, far more frequently. They have a shorter shelf life date because of course, the supply constraints that we have in this country at the moment. So I don't know how consumers are mitigating that. But one of the interesting trends I saw in this report is that fewer people are going online. And apparently a lot of that has to do with pensioners having realised how to shop online during the pandemic, when, of course, they were scared of contracting COVID and advised to stay indoors. But now they realise they want the interaction with people, and they've abandoned online shopping habits. Not so much for the young, but what we're also seeing with middle ages and sort of young families is that people working from home more often, so they won't, say, on their daily commute, stop by the supermarket and pick something up for dinner. So it's a sign that things are changing. And one of the reasons, just finally, people know about this is because people are sticking to loyalty schemes now. So obviously, as we know, in the past, grocery firms have really used these loyalty schemes to get an idea of what their customers are wanting and buying and how frequently they're buying those products. So now they have a really clear idea. It's an idea. It shows you that big data really is showing us how shopping habits are changing, and big price increases are really affecting that.
Absolutely. And finally, a choir that's refusing to sing for its supper, or indeed for its vicar. Tell us about this.
Well, this is an interesting story, which I think just speaks to the common trend in the UK and probably elsewhere. People going on strike. So now this choir at St. Mary the Virgin Church in Steeple Ashton, Wiltshire, has said that its vicar has lost a vote of confidence in a recent parish meeting. And as such, he will not leave, he says, because he's been, quote, guided by the Holy Spirit. But they have refused to sing in the choir or play the organ until he's gone. So even the choirs in the UK are striking, which I thought was a sign of our times.
Absolutely. Nina, thank you very much indeed. That's Nina Dos Santos. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Taiwan activated its defence systems today after reporting 37 Chinese military aircraft flying into the island's air defence zone, some of which then flew into the Western Pacific in Beijing's latest mass air incursion. China, which views democratically governed Taiwan as its own territory, has, over the past 3 years, regularly flown its air force into the skies near the island, though not into Taiwan's territorial airspace. Schools across the US East Coast cancelled outdoor activities, airline traffic slowed, and millions of Americans were urged to stay indoors yesterday as smoke from Canadian wildfires drifted south, blanketing cities in thick yellow haze. It's the worst outbreak of wildfire smoke to blanket the northeastern US in more than 20 years, caused by hundreds of forest fires that have scorched 9.4 million acres and forced 120,000 people from their homes. Poor air quality is likely to persist into the weekend. And Indonesian President Joko Widodo has called for better collaboration with neighbouring Malaysia to fight what he calls discrimination against their country's palm oil products. Indonesia and Malaysia are the world's top two producers and exporters of palm oil, a commodity used in everything from lipstick to pizza. His comments today come after the EU passed a law banning imports of commodities linked to deforestation, a move that's expected to hurt exports of palm oil to the bloc. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Violence erupted in Senegal last week following the criminal conviction of populist opposition leader Ousmane Sonko, who's been sentenced to 2 years in jail. At least 16 people have been killed and around 500 have been arrested. Internet access was suspended by the Senegalese government, and the country also temporarily closed its consulates abroad following attacks in Bordeaux, Milan, Paris and New York. Well, joining me now from Dakar is the journalist and filmmaker Ada Grovestans to give us an update. Ada, many thanks for coming on The Globalist. What are the reasons for these protests?
Good morning. Yes, the main reason is the arrest of Ousmane Sonko. Oh, he has been arrested yet, but the conviction and the sentencing of 2 years in prison. He now is still in his house, but people here expect him to be arrested in the coming days. And this man is a very popular potential presidential candidate. He's one of the biggest challengers of President Macky Sall. And this is the with his sentence, he might be ineligible for the coming elections in February 2024. And what makes people so angry that he is already the third opposition candidate who became ineligible after a court case. But what is adding to the anger of the people is that Macky Sall doesn't want to say if he will be running for a third term, which is against Senegal's constitution and unacceptable to most Senegalese, who are not part of the ruling party's coalition. But according to Sall, a constitutional reform adopted in 2016, in which the seven-year term was set to five, gives him the right to run for another five term. But this all adds up to people's anger, especially also because the economy is not really going well. There's been huge inflation in the last coming years. Products have been really became more expensive. These are the main reasons for people to have been going into the streets.
Mm. And how have the police been reacting to all of this?
Yes, this is something that we haven't seen before in Senegal like this. The police have been hitting very, very hard on rioters. They have used excessive force. People have been filming and anybody has been able to see the riot police hitting with their rifles on rioters, even using little boys from around the age of 8 as human shields against rioters who were throwing stones at the riot police. And this has not been seen on one occasion, but on several occasions, which the government has denied. They say these images and what people have seen were manipulated images. But the population isn't convinced of this.
So the government is planning its first gas and petrol production. I wonder if you think Senegal can avoid the so-called oil curse.
Well, the government said that they were going to produce gas and oil at the end of this year, and Macky Sall wanting to stay for a third term and his entourage not stopping him says a lot about the possible things that are at stake, and of course a lot of money coming out when this oil and gas production starts. Macky Sall's brother has been involved, or according to a BBC report, he's been involved in a big corruption with BP. There has not been a case. It hasn't been investigated by the government. So this all worries people about Macky Sall's intentions.
Mm. Aida Groveston's in Dakar, Senegal. Thank you very much for joining us here on The Globalist. It is 7:40 here in London, and that's 15:40 in Tokyo. Now, Japan is struggling to recruit members of the armed forces. One of the reasons for this is because military personnel are banned from having tattoos. But now, due to the shortage of new sign-ups, the government's reconsidering the rule. I'm joined now by Alessio Patalana, who's Professor of War and Strategy in East Asia at King's College London and Director of the King's Japan Programme. Alessio, lovely to speak to you again. Why is there a stigma around tattoos in Japan? What's the history of body ink in the country?
Good morning, Georgina. With an excellent question. So Japan is quite peculiar in this respect, or let me put it differently. Every country has its own particular heritage history when it comes to tattoos. And in Japan, it's been associated for several centuries now with criminality in a way, because already more than a couple of centuries ago in Japan, the tattoos were used to mark people out, right? And to mark them out in relation to something that they had done that was considered inappropriate at the societal level. And then if you fast forward, certainly when criminal organizations, the notorious Yakuza, started to being organized, then tattoos became a mark that distinguished affiliation to clans. So, for example, even to public baths today, the people with tattoos are not accepted. So there is a particular cultural link with tattoos. But of course, the question here, at least the way it was debated in the Diet, by an MP who's a former colonel of the Japanese army, was, well, we need to draw a distinction between tattoos that are a mark of affiliation to gangs, to from tattoos that are more innocent, more in line with current trends on using on the art, as it were.
Alessio, is that the only reason that Japan's struggling to find new recruits, or are there other problems that are making people not keen to join up?
No, I think this is the crux of the matter, because frankly, I mean, you know, as someone who spends regular amount of time in Japan, I wouldn't say, you know, Japan is in no way comparable to large areas of the United States or even in continental Europe, where body art now is mainstream in society, if you want. In Japan, I would be surprised that the youth had really almost non-existent percentages of the youth in Japan, or at least the one that would be of interest to the armed forces, has tattoos. So I'm pretty sure that even though they changed the attitude towards tattoos, that wouldn't necessarily mean the day after that you have incredible skyrocketing jumps in terms of recruitment percentages. I mean, the article that you mentioned is quite clear about the fact that this year, overall, the self-defense forces failed to recruit to the numbers that they were given, something like they under-recruited by almost 50%. So we're talking about something else. Having said so, I think the other reasons, and the usual reason provided in Japan is the fact of the decline of birth rates, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I think that's partly true, but the thing is also that there's two additional issues to consider here. One is the status of the armed forces. The status of the armed forces in the Japanese society has increased over the last couple of decades, in particular since the triple disaster, the March 2011 triple disaster in Tohoku. The perception has improved within society. But at the same time, we are in a moment in time where there is a relatively good and healthy employment rates for youth. So the choice towards going towards, you know, the armed forces is a less natural choice. The second point, the second sort of cause, is that the treatment of the armed forces in terms of housing, pays, retirement schemes, sort of pension schemes. So it's not. I mean, if you compare it in the NATO context, it's definitely not comparable, and certainly not comparable to other professions. And so the first sort of two things to think about is the status and the conditions. And the third one is a general sort of lower perception of the link between, yes, we have a security problem, and you know, it's a social responsibility to think whether you want to do something about it. There is a bit of a disconnect in Japan still about that.
Alessio, thank you very much indeed. That was Alessio Patalano, and this is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Now, as Russia's war in Ukraine rages on, some European allies are worried that military support from Washington will wane as the US enters a divisive presidential campaign. Our next guest has been calling for the US to do more to help Ukraine and to stand up for democracies. Mark Esper served as the 27th United States Secretary of Defense from 2019 to 2020, and he sat down with Monocle's Andrew Muller last week in Bratislava. Andrew began by asking Secretary Esper how concerned he is about the prospect of Donald Trump winning another term.
Well, I am concerned because I don't think he's fit for the job. I've said that. My view is that we need a new generation of leaders from both parties, frankly. And on the Republican side, I'm always looking for somebody that puts country first, somebody that has a great deal of integrity, but then will advance for me, as a Reagan Republican, traditional conservative values and objectives such as, you know, limited regulation, small government, lower taxes, conservative judges, those types of things. But then importantly, you got to be able to grow that base and win elections. Mm. And we've had a problem winning elections the last few years. So that's kind of what I'm looking for on the Republican side.
How serious a threat to that architecture you've described, upheld as it is by the United States, could a second Trump term be? Because I think it's fair to surmise that he probably hasn't calmed down since his first term.
Well, there are any number of ways to look at it, and I'll just take a quick stab off the top of my head here since you asked the question. If you look from the security perspective, pretty much the scaffolding that we've put around the world now since the end of World War II has been multilateral organizations such as NATO, keeping the peace, keeping the allies together in Europe, and then a series of bilateral treaties and relationships in the Indo-Pacific. So think about Japan, Korea, the Philippines, Australia. And Donald Trump has said on multiple occasions that he wants to see the United States withdrawn from NATO and wants to see the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Korea or Japan. And so when you start dismantling that architecture, what you do is you create instability, you create unease among allies, and then you create openings and vacuums for adversaries to step in. That's what concerns me.
What have you made of how the United States under this administration has approached it? Is it any more or less than what you would have expected from what we might think of as a normal White House administration?
I think relatively it's normal if you look at the arc of U.S. foreign policy history since the end of World War II. You know, I think President Biden's record has been mixed. The withdrawal from Afghanistan was abysmal. It hurt our reputation. It hurt our standing on the world stage. And some believe it incented Vladimir Putin in some ways to do what he did in terms of invading Ukraine. And then on Ukraine, it's been mixed, right? On one hand, I think he made some missteps in terms of talking originally about, you know, whether it's a minor incursion versus a major incursion. But then after it happened, right, I think he did a good job bringing the allies together, focused on a broader range of sanctions, and then getting the allies to start thinking about providing arms. But then, I mean, this is kind of the back and forth, but then as the Ukrainians requested things like HIMARS and Patriot and Abrams and F-16s, it's been way too slow. We've been way too self-deterred. And my view is all that's done is prolonged the conflict, the suffering of the Ukrainian people. And it seemed like it was always just, and it wasn't intended this way, I don't think, but always just enough so that they wouldn't lose, but not enough so that they would win. And that's been my frustration for the past 15 months or so with the White House on this topic.
President Putin obviously didn't order the invasion of Ukraine on a sudden whim. During the period that you were serving as Secretary of Defense, was there any talk or any concern about the possibility of Russia escalating further what it had already started in 2014? And was there any talk about, I guess, forestalling that incrementalism we've seen by saying, like, Ukraine needs to be defended and it needs to be defended properly and it needs to be seen to have the allies who will help it do that?
Yeah, well, look, this is where you got to go back. This is another case where, and I try to be very fair to President Trump and the administration I served in, this is where Trump got it right. You know, Obama did not want to provide lethal aid to the Ukrainians, but Trump did. And that's when Javelin started flowing into Ukraine. I spent time in Lviv watching U.S. troops train Ukrainian troops. And I think that factor alone, which has not been talked about a lot, but the fact that we trained them in modern Western tactics and how to use your non-commissioned officers and the proper role of your officers in that, I think that had a big impact on Ukraine's success on a battlefield. So those all happened under the Trump administration. But at the time, I don't think I don't recall us discussing the likelihood of Russia invading Ukraine with the aim to seize it, right? I think the first mistake was actually made in probably 08 when we failed to respond adequately to the Russian invasion of Georgia, and then compounded in 2014 when we failed to respond adequately to the invasion of Crimea and then eventually Donbass.
I mean, I know looking at these things in hindsight is always easy, arguably even self-indulgent, but if you think about what we know now and apply that to 2014 in particular, what would have been a response that might have made Russia rethink itself?
Well, look, you know, hindsight is not, and don't take this wrong, but the hindsight isn't from just, we don't have the hindsight of just 4 or 5 years. Mm. We have the hindsight of human history, right? I mean, this is Reagan, the president I admire most, talked about peace through strength and not tolerating bullies and pushing back on autocrats. And so we've had those lessons, and you can go back further and further and further in time and see those examples, right? And I think we're experiencing that now. I think one of my biggest concerns when Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24th of last year was how would the West react? Because I was concerned about how Beijing would interpret it as another big autocracy looked at invading a smaller democracy for any number of reasons. So I think the hindsight now we should be applying to Beijing and the PRC, which is why I've been pretty outspoken now about we need to stand up the PRC. We need to bring our allies together. We need to work quickly with the Taiwanese on economic packages, on providing them the arms and assistance they need now, on exercises, training, all those things that I believe will deter a Chinese invasion of Taiwan.
Just going back to Ukraine, though, from where we are now, and you spoke earlier about that incrementalism that Ukraine keeps having to ask for the next big thing, whether that's been tanks, long-range missiles, F-16s, etc. Is there now any limit beyond which Ukraine's allies should not go? Have we completely stopped caring about what Russia might regard as an unacceptable escalation? And if we have, is that a wise thing to have done?
Let me put it this way. It'll sound like I'm speaking out of both sides of my mouth. I think we should always consider what's being asked for and how we deliver it. Personally, if I was SecDef, I would be very reluctant to send Ukraine things that the United States needs for its own self-defense, number one. And I'd be reluctant to send things that, if captured by the Russians or found on the battlefield by the Russians, were such high tech that it would create a problem for the United States. But that said, we don't seem to have reached that yet. But I do think that as we provide systems, we should be conscious about how they may be used and how the Russians react, but we should not be self-deterred. That's the difference I make here. And we've been too self-deterred, I think, over the past 15 months when it comes to supplying Ukraine with what they need.
That was the former US Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, speaking to Andrew Muller at the GlobeSec Bratislava Forum. This is The Globalist. Now, finally, let's have a look at biocontrol initiatives which can have unintended consequences and how these might be managed. And is it even right to try to manipulate animal behaviour? Well, Tom Van Duren is Associate Professor and Deputy Director of the Sydney Environment Institute, and he's been pondering this ethical debate. Tom, welcome to the programme. Can we start with the example of cane toads? What's the problem here?
Yeah, well, cane toads were introduced to Australia, and they have basically spread across the top half of the country over the last several decades. And they poison effectively anything that eats them. So they've left a wave of death in their wake. Everything from big crocodiles to monitor lizards to some of our marsupials. So when they eat them, they're basically highly toxic, and they kill a single toad will kill an adult crocodile. So this has had a huge ecological impact right across the top half of Australia.
And so what's been done to counteract that?
Well, a whole lot of things have been tried for a long time, and not a lot of them have worked. But so one of the examples we've been talking about in some of our recent research is an effort to basically teach these animals not to eat the cane toads. So this is through a process called conditioned taste aversion. It's basically exposing these animals to enough of the toxin or a similar toxin that they learn that this taste, this particular kind of toad is going to make them very sick. And they have one bad experience, and they sort of swear off toads from then on. So if that kind of approach, which has been done in the past with animals in captivity, if that can be rolled out on a large landscape level, which is now underway, the hope is that will prevent a whole lot of animals from being killed.
How ethical is it to change wild animal behaviour?
Well, I think in that case, most of the ethical equation seems to be in favour of that kind of intervention. But the approaches we were looking at in our project were very diverse. So there are a whole lot of other cases in which, for example, we're trying to stop coyotes from visiting suburban areas, or trying to stop elephants from entering into farmers' fields, where we're doing things or things are being trialed to sort of haze these animals or to deter them through whether it's difficult noises or painful experiences to teach them to avoid these areas. And there we open up all sorts of important questions about whether those kinds of experiences of distress and pain and possibly even trauma might be justified. And so obviously there are a lot of things in favor of those kinds of interventions too, which is why people are trying them. Often when an elephant enters a farmer's field, that can lead to all sorts of difficult interactions, including the death of the elephant and deaths of local people. So it's there's pros and cons to be weighed up on each side. And the work we've been doing is trying to take a broad look at a whole range of different sites in which scientists are trying to intervene in animal behaviour to achieve positive conservation outcomes, and ask, what are the ethical challenges that emerge here, and how do we think carefully about them and weigh them all up?
Mm. And I mean, how does one then make wise decisions on wildlife management? What needs to be considered? What is it that you're weighing up?
Yeah, well, it's complicated, and in every case, it's a bit different. So we are talking obviously about the kinds of conservation values, whether it's protecting biodiversity or protecting the integrity of ecosystems. We're talking also about animal welfare often and the pain and suffering of individual animals. We might also, in some cases, be talking about whether it's the right thing to do to intervene in an animal's way of life, to teach them to migrate to a different place or to nest in a different place or to eat different things. Do we really want to be having that kind of intervention into animal lives? And then there's all of those impacts on local communities, on livelihoods, on their potentially on traditional cultural practices. So it's a whole lot of different values and potential impacts that need to be weighed up. And that's really about taking the time to talk to local communities and to try and explore what the consequences of different kinds of conservation interventions will be. One of the most interesting things that we were interested in this work is all of those unexpected, unanticipated consequences, which we've talked about as behavioural bycatch. So it's basically where we have a behavioural intervention of some sort or another that tries to change an animal's behaviour, and then other animals get caught up in it. So a good example is efforts to teach seals not to raid fish farms. There have been some trials using deterring noises, which have been described as like the seal equivalent of fingernails on a chalkboard. So by playing these noises, you can keep seals away from the fish farms. But then other animals are also impacted on by those same noises. And it turns out that at least in some cases, some of the toothed whales are even more deterred from entering those areas. So there's these other unexpected knock-on effects that we also need to be trying to anticipate and measure as best we can.
Tom, many thanks. That's Tom van Duren there. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Laura Kramer, Lillian Fawcett and Emma Searle, our researcher, Helmut Pillai, and our studio manager, Nora Hull. After the headlines, there's more music on the way, and the briefing is live at midday in London. I'm Georgina Godwin, and I'll return on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.